From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We're starting at 11 because it's 3 hours now.
You know what tomorrow is?
Tuesday.
And what happens
tomorrow? Oh, the big debate. We're doing we're monitoring a debate. No, we're not monitoring. We're moderating a debate
between
Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley. The first one-on-one. It'll be at 7 o'clock on Channel 2.
That's right. And 89.7 FM, the first one-on-one televised debate. You know, in the United States, 40% of unemployed workers are millennials. And the jokes we tell about kids living in their parents' basements is one that would not get lost in translation. It might not get a lot of laughs either, because youth unemployment is a worldwide crisis, a problem that could also be contributing to terrorism, obviously. As part of the Ground Truth Project, which is headed by Charlie Sennett, one of their largest projects is a special report entitled Generation TBD, Despair and Opportunity for Millennials in an Uncertain Global Economy. This Friday, Charlie will be in New York at a conference about the global youth unemployment crisis. In addition to heading up the Ground Truth Project here at GBH, Charlie is also a news analyst here and the co-founder of Global Post. Good to see you, Charlie.
Good to see you, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Good morning, Charlie Sennett. Before we get to youth unemployment, which I had no idea was as bad as it is, let's talk a little bit closer to home. James Foley Memorial Mass. Tell us about it.
It was amazing. It was a beautiful celebration of his life. October 18th is Jim Foley's birthday, and it would have been his 41st birthday, and his family celebrated his life in the most extraordinary way. You know, we've talked about this before, about how their faith is the song Amazing Grace?
Yes.
They have Amazing Grace. I mean, they stood online for hundreds and hundreds, probably several thousand people at that church, and really received every single one of them with a smile, with a sense of thank you for coming,
wow,
reaching out to people, telling people how appreciative they are of their support. They're so giving. Their faith is so strong. And we know this by if you've been hearing them, and most people have. There's like 94% recognition of the Jim Foley story in the American news audience. Mm. People know this story. And I think one of the most important things is to know the family's faith, how it really strengthened them. But what was cool about this event was it was all of Jim Foley's families. You know, we think of him as a journalist because we're journalists. Foley went to Marquette, where he was taught by the Jesuits. So the Jesuits loved that he had this social justice spirit in his reporting. He then goes on to Teach for America, where he brings this sense of social justice he learns both from his parents and from the Jesuit school into the world. So all these cool young people from Teach for America were there. Then he goes to Northwestern, where he's an amazing student in digital journalism and working across platforms. Then he goes to UMass, where he picks up a degree in narrative creative writing, and he's done a really significant poetry, which he's won prizes for, which I had no idea about until yesterday. The levels of his family were unfurling at this event in the most emotional and beautiful way. And then, you know, I have to say I was really proud to be there sort of representing the family in the field, the tribe of those journalists who go out, risk their lives to tell these stories, to find ground truth, as we call it. Jim Foley was all about ground truth. And Jim Foley's life and the kind of band of brothers and sisters in the field who are sobered by his death, but inspired by his life, was extraordinary.
Are they inspired enough to be contributing to this memorial fund to benefit
they
other
are.
People
Thanks
like
for
Foley
bringing it up.
And their families?
You know, the Foley Legacy Fund is really important. Yes, you know, isn't it amazing that sometimes the people with the least money in the world are the ones who do the most?
Mm.
No, they're really seeing that even these journalists who are, as we all know, journalism's on hard times. Journalists don't have a lot of money, but yeah, they are giving, and we're also seeing that there's a big consensus building around a need to do more right now, a need to recognize that this is a perilous moment for reporting in the world. The Foley Legacy Fund is a big part of that. It's a beautiful cause. Ground Truth is trying to be part of that with training and mentoring the next generation, Committee to Protect Journalists. There are several organizations that see this as a moment to galvanize and really say, what can we do to keep this kind of on-the-ground reporting happening, but be sure we do it safely?
And also, they're also looking into, unless I'm incorrect, Charlie, into the whole issue of hostage taking and how you reconcile trying to rescue someone with the policies of places like the United States.
You're exactly right. The Foley family feels very strongly we need to rethink this policy. Yeah. They're really strong on that.
Well, James Foley, of course, is the person when he was murdered by ISIS who really brought the terror of ISIS to the fore, yeah. And we all discovered them. Last week was a pretty scary week in terms of ISIS, close to Baghdad, you know, taking over this part of this town, Kobani. So this week, anything new? Do we know anything more?
Just more and more bad news. Turkey continues to wait in the wings. I think I wrote my column on that. We talked about it last week. You know, just coming back from Iraq, seeing the Islamic State literally, you know, just across the way in these towns is chilling. And I had the opportunity to see that firsthand, to see a lot of the fighting, these skirmishes, these small little battles that are going on. They continue every day. Little bit of good news around Kobani, little bit of bad news around Kobani. I think it's going to be like this. We're going to see it go back and forth. And as President Obama keeps telegraphing, this is a long fight. This is the long war, just got longer.
Yeah, just one thing about this. And every time I look at you and think, I know I'm overdoing this. Every week I get into this, yeah. But it is true. When you're in places like you were when you called us from northern Iraq and you just left being on the border of a firefight, you get on a plane, mm-hmm. and then you're back in Boston and suburban Boston where you live. What's your head like? I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, literally, you know, 1 minute you're there, and then 1 minute you're here, you're with your family.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Excuse me, that means he doesn't chase people from here to New Hampshire if they cut him off at the red light? Is that what you're trying to get at?
No, I don't know what I'm getting at, but
Go ahead, Charlie.
You know, we've talked about this a lot, and I know you have other stuff you want to get to today. There's so many important issues in the world. But briefly, as a correspondent, I feel really lucky to be on the front line of history, to see history with a sort of ringside seat. And that's a privilege and an honor in a time in which journalism is struggling to fund that kind of reporting. And the Ground Truth Project, you know, we're dedicated to just saying, how do we keep this going? The Boston Globe, great newspaper. We love it. But it had to cut its foreign coverage because of the impact economically of the web on journalism. We at Global Post, we started Global Post to try to counter that. Now we started the Ground Truth Project to fund very expensive reporting in the field. Frontline here at WGBH does it all the time. Their series on ISIS is incredible,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but wait a second. I want to
PRI,
know about you.
The world does it all the time.
We know how great the work is. We do.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you're here. What is it like for you? What is
personally?
Your,
okay.
No, not being there, but without I asked you last week.
Yeah.
Being
does he
there,
sweat the
and
small
then all of a
stuff?
Sudden you're at a no. deli in your neighborhood. Mm. I mean, what is that like?
You could ask my kids if I have little sort of these very light shades of PTSD. You get them absolutely when you're a correspondent and you're in a place where you're afraid. It carries into your life, and I won't hide that from you. It's not anywhere near what the military would uh-huh. experience because, remember, they are dealing with the idea of they are engaging in combat. They are delivering, you know, bullets to the other side. We're watching. It's very different. But I can tell you, we share an element of fear, of being very close to very serious action. I've often had guys, even guys, a guy I know in the Special Forces who lives very near me. We were talking the other day, and he said he couldn't believe some of the battles I'd witnessed. Like, that's stuff that even a veteran in the Special Forces may not get that level of number of experiences. But I can tell you it's very different when you're in the military and you are assigned as a part of that conflict and when you're a journalist watching it. What we go through is much less, but there are shades of PTSD. And there's one funny story I'll tell you, which is we came off of all these years of reporting. And I say we because my family lived with me over in the Middle East. Our kids were born over there, three of them. We have these four boys. My wife and I just went through all these 8 out of 12 months of the year in Iraq and Afghanistan for 5 years. I was wiped out. The Boston Globe gave me the Nieman Fellowship, right? The most peaceful thing you could do. I study Irish poetry, life drawing. I come down off all the conflict reporting for a while, and we bought a beautiful home out in Harvard, Mass. And I'm sitting there on the front porch with my wife, Julie, on the first day we own the home with our first cup of coffee. And what do I hear over the ridge from Fort Devens? Close air support, 50 caliber machine guns. I can hear mortars being fired. And so I looked over at Julie, like with this cup of coffee, and said, "You hear that, right? Like, I'm not having some weird flashback here." what we've realized is we are attuned to the training at Fort Devens. Every day at Fort Devens, young people are training to go into Afghanistan to risk their lives, right? And hopefully not to go back on the ground in Iraq, but maybe, and maybe it'll need to be done. But what I hear when I'm on our soccer fields and I'm with our kids watching their games, I can hear that on a Saturday morning. It's there. And it interests me that some of the other parents hear it, but many don't. And one of the things in America we forget is that 1% of our population in the military is out there. And we also forget that there are correspondents, a much smaller family, a much smaller percentage. But the people in the field who are correspondents observing that are also out there. And when I hear that sound, yeah, I'm reminded of the service of the military in a way. With my Dunkin' Donuts on a soccer field, others might not be. But I'm also reminded of my friends and my colleagues and this band of brothers and sisters of which Jim Foley was a part, who do this work every day, not just American and British and European, Iraqi journalists, Syrian journalists. These are people who are trying their best to bring us the stories from the field, and we need to hear them.
But you know what I wonder? You know, we've gone through this. We've been very worked up in the United States of America over Ebola. Some would say we've been hysterical over Ebola. And you must have a perspective, having gone to these places where people are seeing their families killed, their villages wiped out. You know, we're supposed to be land of the free, home of the brave. And sometimes I don't feel like we are very brave when we're in a total panic.
Hasn't it been amazing to watch the Ebola crisis turn into partisan politics on the eve of the midterms?
Yes.
It's really been stunning to see how a world health crisis, which deals with issues of the lack of clean water, the lack of development in these countries, Africa is on the edge of great success. It's on the edge of growing its middle class. It's trying very hard through the help of nations like our own that have done a lot of development. And it's doing well on its own because it has thriving businesses. Africa's on the cusp of success. And then along comes this world health crisis. And to see the reaction, instead of it being, what can we do to help? It's this reaction of fear seems very un-American to me. We've always reached out to the world to try to help. Why are we suddenly politicizing this and saying that, you know, that this new czar is a political appointee? Yeah, he is, but he may also be a very efficient manager.
Can I tell you something? I'm so glad you said that. I have rarely been as appalled by the debate. Okay, he doesn't have medical experiences. The assumption is that Barack Obama picked Ron Klain because he's a political hack and doesn't want him to deal with a crisis in America. Enough already. Support the guy. Try to get him to do his job well, to reduce, as you call it, the panic in America, and move on. Everything is partisan. It is staggering to me.
It really is. Now, you guys will be hosting the debate tomorrow night.
Yes, we will.
This is a time of a political climate where even Jean Shaheen became part of this global debate at the Foley Memorial Service. She was there. And she suddenly, you know, I was watching some of the local media talking with her and the questions about, are we doing enough with the Islamic State? And this is just honoring a kid from New Hampshire, right? I just saw some of the vitriol. You could feel it among the press corps, even there at this beautiful celebration of Jim's life. But with the Ebola thing, I do think it's worth pointing out that it's broken down on these lines of which the Democrats are saying, what happens when you cut funding to the CDC? What happens when you cut all of this foreign aid funding that hurts development, that brings clean water, that allows people to have the access to that water, to wash their hands, to stop disease? We need government in order to really approach a lot of the world's very complex problems. And yeah, okay, if the Republican proposal is let's shut down our borders and keep people from West Africa out of here, that's absurd and fearful. And anyone who understands crisis knows fear is debilitating.
By the way, you say absurd, and would you say fearful? I'm betting that before the week is over, the President of the United States buys into that travel ban. I mean, he said he was open to it. He didn't think it was appropriate now, but let's watch, and we'll talk about it next week. Can we move to another thing? The Pope, the Synod just ended, and we're going to talk to the two reverends in an hour or so about the hope that was raised last week and that was arguably dashed, at least in part. When the Pope speaks, arguably the highest profile religious leader in the world, What Marjorie's raising this all the time in terms of American presidential politics. What impact does that have around the world and on world leaders? Do people care? I mean, I know they shake their head, yeah. You compliment it. Does it matter?
Well, you had that amazing discussion right here where the question was raised, did anyone really vet this guy? And she was wonderful talking about, like, here is this effort to reach out across a lot of the culture wars that have made the Catholic Church look very rigid, particularly under Pope Benedict. And say, hey, we got to do more for divorced couples. If you were divorced, you should be able to return to the church. Gay marriage, that beautiful quote from the Pope about who am I to judge. This is a church that is allowing itself to admit that there's an open debate. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to abandon the core traditional values that come with the Catholic teaching. You're a fool if you think that's going to happen. But I thought John Allen in The Globe had a wonderful observation that, okay, they watered it down. They pulled back from a lot of that language because it was a draft document. And the synod is going to produce a document that will be more in line with some of the conservative teaching that we're used to. But John made the good point that what's happened is a spirit of transparency, of yes. opening up the debate so that people who are Catholic, and I would include myself in this group as someone who grew up Boston Irish Catholic, as wayward as I am and as much as I struggle with it, like just about every Catholic I know, this is a debate that's needed. It's had at every dinner table. It's had at every family gathering. It's had in all the small settings I know where your faith comes up and where these issues are discussed. We need a civil discourse that doesn't go down into base partisan politics, where you really talk about a modern world and whether or not that church is going to inform the way you live it. And I think that the Pope has opened that spirit up, and he's done it. I think people listen when the Pope speaks. When he spoke on economic inequality and we were reporting on that, I thought that was resonating. I thought you could really hear people recognizing this is a Pope who understands that the penchant for the poor is embedded in Christ's message, right?
Right.
That's unique. One thing just to shift a little bit. Can I read a quote from Pope Francis
Absolutely.
About youth unemployment?
Oh, yes. Right up your
okay.
alley, yeah.
So the Pope has been very eloquent on this other big issue we've been looking at the Ground Truth Project. We're doing a big special report, which you gave a wonderful introduction to, called Generation TBD, a special report on Global Post. Big conference that we'll be co-hosting this Friday on it. But the Pope has been way ahead on this. So remember, President Obama gave a speech, was it 2 weeks ago, on the millennials, and he used capital M for millennial in his speech. Not only is it a voting block, it's a generation with a capital M now. So he was behind Pope Francis, though, who much earlier over the summer said about youth unemployment, this is the most serious of the evils that afflict the world these days. Youth unemployment, lack of opportunity, despair. That's the soil in which militancy grows. That's the soil in which despair grows. That's the soil in which all of these problems we struggle with in the world are happening. And so we're at Global Post's, this special report, our team from Ground Truth, we're trying to shape that debate. We got 22 reporters going around the world, reporting from 11 countries. This is all up on Global Post and the Ground Truth Project right now. This is a really important debate. You have numbers that are just staggering
like
about the levels.
Give us a couple of examples.
And why?
Okay. So for example, highest youth unemployment, according to the World Bank, in the world is Bosnia. Kind of a surprising one for me. I didn't really think that would be the highest one, but it is. Post-war society, no jobs. They have not integrated well in the aftermath of war. Our tremendous reporter, Elizabeth Herman, who's right from Massachusetts, went to Tufts, brilliant young reporter and photographer. She revealed the stories of a generation that's not only are the 57%, if I'm remembering that number correctly, of those people ages 15 to 24 have no jobs. They don't have anything to look forward to, so many of them are migrating. They're leaving Bosnia. So the ones who do have skills leave. The ones who stay have nothing. But they tend to at least have an opportunity to get into college, and it's this sort of cafe and bar society where no one's doing anything. In that squandered opportunity comes the potential for the resentments of the past in a part of the world that can ignite at any minute back into ethnic conflict. That is just this smoldering problem there. Another one that's really dramatic is Nigeria. So that in Nigeria, the numbers are just slightly less than Bosnia. But what they don't factor in is that Nigeria has a massive group of people who are doing really, really simple little jobs like selling things on the street that they include as a job. So their numbers, by other calculations, are as high as 80% of the young people between the ages 15 and 24 neither have a job nor are in any kind of formal education, not high school or college. So this is a squandered generation. So there's this tattoo that street kids in Nigeria have that says right across their chest, born throwaway.
Oh, man.
And they are sort of embracing this notion that they're a throwaway generation. But with all the despair, with all the violence that this could beget, Nigeria, certainly the militancy of Boko Haram draws on the despair of this generation that has nothing to do. But Marjorie, to your point, what causes this? What causes it is a change in global economy, an economy in which so much of the digital revolution and the technological revolution has shifted the kind of work we do. And it's dramatic. These are big forces at work. We need big, big minds to think through how we're going to even understand the problem before we begin to address it. But I also want to really quickly say, we call it Generation TBD, as in to be determined, because there's incredible opportunity right now. We saw this in Egypt, of all places. The young people who were part of the Facebook revolution, who are really good at social networking and technology, who made a movement happen that toppled a dictator who held for 30 years. What happened afterwards? That's up for grabs. That's still in motion. But what they haven't lost is the energy of innovation that came with that powerful movement of coming together on Facebook pages and through Twitter feeds. And we're seeing great technological innovation in Egypt. And actually, very interesting, a lot of angel investors going into the Middle East, picking up on the Arab Spring, and recognizing there's a movement here, people who understand how to move people toward positive change. So I don't want to call it all doom and gloom. Our great hope is that Generation TBD will be determined as one that also affects change at a time of great change.
Last thing on that, though, I don't want to be doom and gloom either. If you don't want to be it, I don't want to be it. Okay. But I'll be halfway there. You know, we had Naomi Klein the other day and
yeah,
talking about a new book
about
you know, how much time do we have to begin to fix this climate change nightmare.
It
seems to me, when you're talking about the kind of numbers you're talking about, 57%, whatever it is,
yeah,
I assume the clock's ticking there too. I mean, the 15 or whatever number, 18 to 24 year olds are going to become 24 to 35 year olds. And then, so what is, how urgent? I mean, it seems to me the urgency is colossal.
The urgency is extraordinary. World Economic Forum has put this as a priority issue, right up there with income inequality as something that has to be dealt with. And of course, it's woven into the arguments around income inequality, right? But the President of the United States put his finger on it when he said that this millennial generation right here in America, right here in Boston, where we have all these college students, what they face going out into the world is the reality that they may not do as well as their parents. Now, all three of us are part of a generation that did do better than its parents. I know that I feel very fortunate that I did. You know, my chance to go to UMass and to go ahead and to get the funding I needed and to be able to work a summer job to pay for it, I don't know that exists anymore. And I think we have to think through opportunities for young people. So our conference on Friday is solutions-based. We're going to thought leaders, great mayors from around the country and around the world. We're bringing in economists. We're bringing in people to really start to focus on solutions to this problem. We hope our journalism at Ground Truth frames the issue. And then we want to convene so that we start thinking about solutions. So, and one solution I see emerging is a sort of return not just to internships, but to that really old-fashioned apprenticeship, hiring young people for positions where they're going to get trained on the job to do much bigger jobs. And the other one is innovation economy, looking at startups, looking at technology as the way to unleash the talents of young people. And, you know, I was with my Palestinian friend and colleague just recently on this trip. So much despair. We're looking at devastated Gaza. We're looking at the walls of the West Bank. We're looking at all this terrible stuff. He's so depressed. He's had very serious health problems. He's really, like so many Palestinian people, he's really been through trauma, and so many Israeli people too. But I think to live in the West Bank is uniquely difficult. He was so depressed until his son showed up to meet us for coffee And his it was like this light went on in my friend Zaid Ghazali's eyes. His son arrives like anyone would with their son. Son's name is Adam. Adam was talking about his startup. And he's talking about how excited he is about it. And it's a really cool idea. And he said, and we've got Israeli funding. We got some Palestinian funding. And I said, well, isn't that kind of controversial for you coming from the West Bank? And he said, you know what? We're not an Israeli startup. We're not a Palestinian startup. We're not an Israeli-Palestinian startup. We're just a startup. And this quote I loved. He said, you know what? Technology has no checkpoints.
That's a great line. Let's end on an up note, which we almost never do with you, Charlie Sennett. Charlie, great to see you.
Great to see
and
you guys.
People should check out Global Post and Ground Truth Project because it's great, great stuff and with really talented reporters. And you had a great column yourself there, Charlie Sennett. We'll say that as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
Charlie is a news analyst here at WGBH. He's also the co-founder of Global Post and Ground Truth Project. Friday, he'll be in New York at a conference at the International House to discuss what we've just been talking about, global youth unemployment. Charlie, great to see you.
Thanks.
Up next, we're hitting the campaign trail with our weekly political roundup. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.